This week, the blue chip U.S. equities and gold gain ground ahead of next week's FOMC meeting. Well, welcome back, everybody. It's great to be with you. We have another big show lined up this weekend. Your host, Chris Waltzek, here with you. Ralph Acampora of Altera Wealth Management makes his debut on the show. The respected Wall Street veteran says U.S. equities have not even had a 10% correction since 2011. He's a bit nervous. He's seeing some negative signs, but thinks it'll be just a correction amid a very strong bull market. And I happen to agree with him. And he's looking for higher rates to put a cap on bonds, adding further momentum to the equities. His Dow theory work is flashing a warning signal, with the transports just not following through like the Dow Jones Industrials, similar to the year 2000 stock market top. And he wants everybody to rotate through the sectors as the bull market moves higher, noting also that he thinks exposure to gold is advisable. And of course, Robert Kiyosaki, America's rich dad, has penned a new bestseller, Second Chance for Your Money, Your Life and Our World, a book for every level of investor. He just added another 100 U.S. gold eagles to his big stockpile, and he's nervous over the $700 trillion derivatives, which have grown to over $1.2 quadrillion in size. He wants everyone to watch his new free video, The Man Who Could See the Future. It's free of charge on our webpage right now. And then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. Remember to record your questions and comments. I'll get to them as soon as I can. Our new hotline is not toll-free, but it's open 24 hours, 7 days a week. You can leave your first name or stay anonymous if you like. The Q&A hotline, 1-206-666-5370. Goldseek.com radio begins now with the market recapitulation. Partly sunny skies were seen over the precious metals markets this week. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, the yellow metal was higher by about $9, ending at $11.80. Silver gave back just 17 cents, finishing at $15.77 an ounce. The XAU Gold and Silver Equities Index fell just 1 point, off about 2%, ending at $66.55, while West Texas Intermediate crude added a dollar, finishing near $60 per barrel. On Friday, Chancellor Angela Merkel attempted to make a peace offering among creditors and Greek officials, asking all concerned to return to the negotiating table in the Greek bailout talks. Following the International Monetary Fund ending negotiations, citing lack of progress. According to one media source, analysts at Capital Economics are calling for greater likelihood of a Greek default to add further support for gold, which has led to a very aggressive gold forecast of $1,400 an ounce this year. Next week, Fed officials will meet for another FOMC meeting on June 16th and 17th, ending on next Wednesday. Policymakers are expected to hold rates steady until at least the September meeting or perhaps the December meeting later this year. After next week's meeting, Fed Chair Janet Yellen will make comments at a press conference. One analyst expects the Fed to tip its hand, calling for a more hawkish stance and perhaps sending the U.S. dollar sharply higher. But there was really no signs of accumulation in the greenback at all this week. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, last week, nearly every asset class was lower, and then this week, it was, well, pretty much the same thing with one major exception, and that was gold. Clearly, the Greek debt saga and next week's FOMC meeting ignited some interest in the safe haven. For 3 weeks, the U.S. dollar has been under considerable pressure, helping the yellow metal, I think, find support this week. Still, there aren't a lot of signs of accumulation in the metal, so I still think caution is advisable until we see an uptrend. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly sunny weather was seen over the New York Stock Exchange. Investors were concerned by growing Greek debt default concerns following a breakdown in negotiations. The Dow Jones Industrials average ended at 17,849, up 50 points for the week. The S&P 500 ended at 20,094, up only 1 point, and the Nasdaq closed off fractionally at 50,51. In domestic economic news, U.S. producer prices in May climbed the most in 2 years, according to a Labor Department report on Friday. The University of Michigan's preliminary June Consumer Sentiment Index topped expectations, while core prices, which exclude the volatile food and energy sectors, added just 0.1%. The report came on the heels of solid employment numbers. While retail sales surged in May, additional signs of robust economic conditions were seen. For the most part, corporate America is chugging along nicely, while I think the middle and working classes continue to struggle, unfortunately. One very positive sign this week stemmed from the IPO Wingstop, a restaurant. Shares blasted higher in the first day of trading, closing higher by 61% in the first day. Extreme price gains like this in IPO markets tend to be emblematic of a robust underlying market, but one that also is likely leading to a crescendo, as we saw in the year 2000. I think this suggests the markets have more steam left in the engines than the naysayers are predicting. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, investor fear levels increased markedly this week, as viewed by our favorite 7-indicator sentiment index, and I think this suggests that selling may be overdone and extended on the downside. Investors will be watching for hawkish comments from the Fed chair next week following the FOMC meeting conclusion on Wednesday. And coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with our big guest this week, Ralph Acampora and Robert Kiyosaki, America's Rich Dad. We'd like for to stay with us right here. Thanks for choosing GoldSeek.com radio. Today's featured guest, author of Second Chance and the Rich Dad series, Robert Kiyosaki. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show the best-selling author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad series, Robert Kiyosaki. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you.
Begin today with the precious metals. It's been kind of a boring year for our favorite metal here, gold and silver. You're probably not selling any of your stockpile. Are you interested in adding to it, though?
Yeah, I just bought another 100 Eagles gold. I hear all kinds of predictions that gold will go to 600 an ounce and all that. I just don't save money. I save gold and silver, and I don't spend it. So that's my strategy. I'm not recommending it, but I've been doing that for years, and that's why I have so much gold and silver hidden in a place nobody can find.
Money just has a funny way of disappearing. You know, in cash, it gets spent. In bank accounts, it gets rehypothecated. It disappears. But when it's in that physical gold eagle form, it stays that way for thousands of years. So hat tip for that. Any other investment classes? Are you interested in stocks? The last time I talked to you, no interest whatsoever in financial assets.
Well, I have stocks. It's not much, but $1 million worth, you know, but I don't trust it. That's the problem. I do trust gold and silver. I'm a precious metals investor also, guns and bullets, the most precious metals you can have, because if you have gold and silver, you need guns and bullets, unfortunately. But they'll never find it. That's the problem. They're not in this country.
Of course, you have to get past probably a 50 caliber barrage of lead, though.
I went to military school, and I'm a Marine pilot, so I don't have any problem using guns. That's the world we live in. So that's why my precious metals are gold and silver, guns and bullets.
Very good. What about real estate? Any interest these days? Are we getting toppy for the typical home, or is that not really where you're searching for opportunity?
I bought another 1,600 units, apartment houses, and the best part about it, I used 100% debt. You see, real estate is about debt and taxes. It's not about real estate. And I don't flip property, and because then you have a capital gains event. I use debt, and the more debt I use, the more taxes, the less taxes I pay.
But doesn't that require a down payment, though, of some sort, some type of skin in the game?
Yeah, for most people, but not me. I am into financial education, and when I came back from Vietnam in 1973, my poor dad said to go to school, get my MBA, and instead I went to become an investor, and I took a real estate investment course, and the course taught me how to use no money or how to use 100% debt to acquire property to produce cash flow. So that's what I studied most of my life. I don't want a career. I don't want to climb the corporate ladder. I don't want a job. And I don't like paying taxes. So that's why I study, you know, real estate, oil and gas. And that is the same as Elon Musk. You know, there's a LA Times has had an article about him as how the government gives him money, subsidizes him. That's because the true entrepreneurs are partners with the government. And so a lot of people who are employees and corporate warriors and all that, they got really upset, you know, as school teachers. Well, why does the government give Elon Musk billions of dollars? Because Elon Musk is doing what the government does, and the same reason the government gives me billions of dollars, not million, billions, but millions, because I do what the government wants done. I'm a partner with the government. That was the book Cash Flow Quadrant, you know, ES, employees and self-employed on one side, business owners and investors on the other. And so the B's and I's don't make a lot of money, but we don't pay tax because we're partners with the government. We are incentivized to do what the government wants done. And you can't do that without financial education. So that's what people get upset about.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. You know, Elon Musk dropped out of school, self-educated, and has created multiple industries. Actually, I think he was the founder of PayPal, if I'm not mistaken. Sold that off to the tune of at least $1 billion. Parlayed that into, of course, Tesla Motors. Now a thriving solar industry that he's created. It's more than just entrepreneurial. I mean, there is a humanitarian aspect and other philanthropic aspects to his work. People coming up with novel solutions to problems, everyday problems that we all need. Everyone wins, but you know, the system isn't set up to encourage that anymore. It seems like we are, as you alluded to, gearing more towards the socialistic spectrum instead of, you know, the entrepreneurial.
Absolutely. The reason I don't recommend people go to school is you learn to be an employee, or you become a doctor and lawyer, you learn nothing about money. So as I said, you read my book, Cash Flow Quadrant. On one side, employees and small business as self-employed. Other side is big business and investors, and most of those guys drop out of school.
The list goes on and on. I mean, everyone from Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, so many folks.
Walt Disney, Henry Ford, Zuckerberg, Thomas Edison, they all dropped out of school. Oprah Winfrey. And the reason is because they don't want to be employees. And so the government gives, like I make millions of dollars and don't pay taxes because I partner with the government. The reason I buy gold and silver is because what's going on today in 2015 is there's a tug of war in the world economy between inflation and deflation. So as you guys in gold and silver know, the governments are terrified of deflation because that causes depression. So what they're doing is they're printing money called quantitative easing to keep the economy afloat rather than collapsing. So this is really good for anybody in the banking services business. And people like me who use debt, because I get all this cheap money coming at me, whereas the people on the ENS side are saving money, which is absolutely ludicrous. Why would you save money when the government's printing money? And why would you invest in the stock market when the stock market's being propped up by printed money? So you have this tug of war going on. And if, let's say, it's like, let's say two big teams are going back and forth, but there will come a day of reckoning when one will win. So if it collapses and we go into depression, then what will happen is the government will go into helicopter money and just pour money all over the whole world. And that's when those who invest in gold and silver, like instruments, will do very well.
Can you give us just a couple of takeaway points for the listeners, for people who are about to download, you know, Second Chance, your latest bestseller from, let's say, Amazon.com or online? Download it to their Kindle or probably an audio. If it's not yet, it probably will be an audio format through Audible.
To understand the crisis, you have to study the past. And many people think the last crash, which came in 2007, which I predicted in 2002, the last crash people think was a real estate crash. It wasn't a real estate crash. It was a derivatives crash. In 2007, there was $700 trillion in derivatives. Now, to keep this economy afloat, and into the present, we're now at 1.2 quadrillion in derivatives. So that's why I'm saying that when you read Second Chance, you'll understand that what the government is telling us is a pack of lies, and that we're in this tug of war. The government is so afraid of a monetary collapse of the U.S. dollar. That's what they're terrified of. And when the euro collapses and the yuan collapses, then the dollar's going to go up, but then that will collapse. So that's why I'm saying, why do I buy gold and silver? It's because I'd rather have gold and silver, because when the tug of war ends, gold and silver will probably, I can't guarantee it, will be the best thing you could buy. For somebody like me, I use debt, because when I have millions of dollars in debt, I can pay it off with cheap money. But I don't recommend what I do. That's why I love gold and silver, is because gold and silver have been real money for thousands of years. The dollar has only been in existence for a few years. So why would you save dollars when you can save gold and silver, guns and bullets?
I'm sure you have some key tips that readers will just sink their teeth into to help them, you know, navigate through these really difficult economic times we're facing.
Second Chance is written very simply, a lot of pictures and graphs in it. But they're not my pictures and graphs, they're yours, government pictures and graphs, so a 10-year-old kid can understand it. Then you can make up your own mind to do what you want to do based upon your skill set. Like, I have the skill set of understanding tax law and using debt. Most people don't have that, but you can still buy gold and silver. Or you can buy, like, the Prudent Bear Fund, which is a fund that does well when the markets crash. Now, it's up to you, depending upon your study, your intelligence, and your experience. Is I would recommend people right now borrowing $600 million in debt, because that's where I'm going. I want to borrow more money.
Anything on the radar screen that you'd like to share with the listeners today? Something important going forward in the next few months for folks to keep their eyes on?
I have a video coming out calling The Man Who Could See the Future, and it comes out on June 15th. It's free. It's 60 minutes long. It kind of explains why I wrote Second Chance. But even if you don't read Second Chance, you'll understand why we're in this financial crisis. So Second Chance is a video because most people can endure a 60-minute video. It's like watching 60 minutes on television. And they may get educated, and they may want to read Second Chance, and they may want to take action rather than just go to school, get a job, work hard, save money, and invest for the long term in a 401k. Watch the video. Go to richdad.com. It's called The Man Who Could See the Future. It's 60 minutes long. You'll learn as much from that, and then you can read Second Chance. June 15th for free.
Robert Kiyosaki, I want to thank you so much.
Well, I do it because you guys have an important service to render, very important service. Given the state of the economic affairs and printing money, quantitative easing, and lack of financial education in school, I support you guys.
We couldn't do it without giant folks like yourself who have really made a name over the years. I mean, that's what brings everybody to the show. So, Robert Kiyosaki, we thank you so much, and please keep up the great work.
Thank you. You too.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Today's featured guest, Ralph Acampora of Altero Wealth Management. Ralph Acampora, it's a pleasure to have him on the show. He makes his debut appearance today, co-founder of the Chartered Market Technician designation. That's right, CMT, director of technical research at Smith Barney, Kidder Peabody, Prudential Securities, Knight Securities. What a curriculum vitae, published author, and now head at Altero Wealth Management. Welcome to the show, Mr. Acampora.
Thank you, Chris.
In your latest Longview report, you note the U.S. economy appears to have decoupled from the rest of the world. And we're seeing signs of cracks, aren't we, in the foundations? We're seeing the U.S. dollar act in a very different way. U.S. stocks, new all-time highs, the Dow Jones at like 117, 118-year high in recent weeks and months, and the domestic economy showing some strength. Can you tell us more, please?
We went through a very, very difficult time in 07, 08, and early 09. I call it a near global depression. To come out of that takes time. And that's exactly what the market's been doing. The market itself has been reflecting the slow but steady progress. It's frustrating for a lot of people, myself included. There were times when I was looking for a correction, felt that the need was great. for this correction, and we have not had a 10% correction, as you know, since I think it was October of 2011. Now, having said all that, the market itself is a leading economic indicator. And I think the stubbornness to the upside indicates that the U.S. is on the right path. We just have to take time. We'll have some corrections on the way up, but longer term, I am a secular bull.
You know, when you say something like a depression, for those of us with the peculiar mental capacity, maybe it is, to stare at the markets, look at the charts, I would even maybe be so bold as to say it could have been worse than the Great Depression. It looked like it was going to be the end of all markets from my perspective. Never seen blue chip and bellwether stocks trading, you know, at 90, 80, 70% off their highs, trading like penny stocks, many of them. And you're right, we've had quite a rebound, but it doesn't seem like the everyday investor on Main Street has picked up to the idea that stocks are safe again. It seems like many people, you ask them, they say, oh, 2008 was all I needed to see. I've washed my hands of this. Will this bull, do you think, continue to run until the typical investor returns to the market?
That's when classic bull markets end, when you have excessive public speculation. The last time we have seen anything of that magnitude, of course, was in the late 90s. And I suspect we're a long, long way from that happening. Just look at the amount of cash and money in money market funds and treasuries. The public is, as you said, and rightly so, the public is not in this market, hasn't been in this market in a big way. I think as time goes by, and I'm talking in the next 5, maybe 8, 10 years, when Mrs. O'Brien opens up her monthly statements and starts seeing that she's losing money in this bond market, I strongly believe that over the next 10, 15, 20 years, interest rates definitely will be going back up in a significant way. It'll take time, but it'll be a significant way. And when the statements start reflecting this loss in bonds, that will be when the public starts migrating back into equities. And again, I think this is a long-term effort, a situation which only adds years to the secular bull. So it all fits. Just got to be patient. Stay with equities.
You mentioned raising interest rates, and this has obviously been a concern, particularly to the precious metals crowd for some time, because typically gold, silver are viewed as non-interest-bearing asset classes or an asset class. And as such, as rates are low, well, they tend to outperform paper, if you will. But when rates increase, they have greater competition from dividend-bearing securities, such as equities, as you mentioned. But if we look back in time, in the 1970s, rates were increasing throughout most of that decade, and it was one of the greatest precious metals bull markets in history. You've gone on record in your 2015 Longview, a proponent of gold allocation. You think that this is warranted. Can you tell us more, please?
Yeah, especially in the position I'm in. I talk to clients, high net worth clients in the Mideast. In their particular situation, they definitely need another form of asset allocation. So a percent of a large amount of money should be dedicated to that. But when I'm talking to the individual that's walking around the street that doesn't have that kind of asset, I don't think you have to be overly weighted in gold or silver. A small portion, yes, of course, but not to the excess. And I say this only because I need more evidence to suggest that gold and silver has finally bottomed. Gold right now is about $1,175, and you just wouldn't want to see it below $1,150, and then I think you'd be talking triple digits. And that. And again, this is not hard and fast. If people feel a little bit more comfortable with the precious metals, that's fine, but I wouldn't overweight my position.
Probably creating a great capitulation opportunity for longer-term investors, but it's great to hear the voice of reason. It's not going to be a popular view with our investors, but you know, it might help folks focus still in the bull market, which is still equities, and we want people to wake up to that. And you know, you do need that allocation because you never know when you might have a Cyprus-like moment, a rehypothecation, and there's also, of course, the opportunity for unscrupulous currency machinations. And I like your idea of having some allocation regardless of your stance because, you know, we're not like King Canute. We can't command the tides. We're not sure exactly what tomorrow will bring. So all good advice. I would point out that gold in terms of the ruble looked destined to collapse, but it entered a massive bull market and increased over 100% in just a few months' time.
I'm an old timer. I've been in the business close to 50 years. And the oldest theory in technical analysis is Dow theory. I think it's flashing a warning signal. Let me explain what that's all about. First of all, Dow theory is not a short-term indicator. It identifies major trends, primary bull markets and primary bear markets. How does it do that? Well, there are two averages involved, Dow Jones Industrials, the producers of products, and the Dow Jones Transportation Average, the shippers of products and people, okay? When they're both making new closing, that's be closing highs, that's said to be in a primary bull market. Whenever they divert, in other words, one's making a new high and the other one is non-confirming, that's the important word, non-confirmation. That happened earlier this year. Actually, the transportation average peaked on January 29th and has not been able to make a new high since then. And begrudgingly, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average has been making new highs recently. That divergence suggests that perhaps there is a problem somewhere. When I drill down and look at the components in the Dow Jones Transportation Index, I'm horrified by what I see. The rails are just falling apart. Now I'm starting to see the airlines getting tagged again today.
Transportation seemed to help bring us out of the quagmire, didn't they?
Absolutely. In fact, that was one of the indicators I used. A very good friend of mine that had a Piper Cub plane and would fly over somewhere in Montana and see how many trains were just sitting in the sidelines.
The Acampora indicator.
Yes. And he reported back to me, he said, there were 100 miles of railroad tracks just full of trains parked there. And then he started to report to me, well, gee, Ralph, there's only 60 miles. So I know those trains were coming out of the parking lot. And I suspect they're going back into that parking lot.
When we talk about the Dow, I haven't studied that too close, not in many years. And I do know it's based on Charles Dow, who, of course, created the index. Also, I think he was an integral part of the Wall Street Journal originally. How accurate do you find this? Is this something that we should all be taking very seriously?
You know, you can have non-confirmation, which is what I was talking about, for months, several months, maybe many months. In fact, the year 2000, the first week of the new millennium, we had the same problem. Dow Industrial would close at an all-time new high in the transportation peak 6 months before that. And for the next 12 months, the market was in a wide trading range until it finally got its bear market in early 2001. So we're 5 months into this very choppy trading range. That could last for a while, but you definitely don't want to see new reaction lows in the industrial average. I suspect anything below 17,000 on the Dow would mean, for me, and I'm being conservative, would mean that we started a Dow theory primary bear market. And always remember that Dow theory is never early. You usually lose the first 10% going out of the market, lose the first 10% starting a primary bull market. And you say, well, gee, this isn't a very useful tool. Well, if I can capture 80% of the primary move up and 80% of the primary move down, just using this indicator, I'd be very happy. And I see that. It's not a trading tool. It's just a confirmation. All it's saying to me is the little dashboard light on my car is flashing and says, Ralph,
if it helps you capture the trend, that's what all the professionals are after. They leave the daily and weekly noise and gyrations to the speculators. That would certainly bode well for commodities, which have just suffered through nearly 4 years of some of the toughest consolidation and, I guess you'd say, bear market in decades. That would seem to indicate that maybe the precious metals might find a bottom in the next year or so. Does that seem plausible?
I've seen stock markets go up and down with commodities doing the same.
Just like we saw last week, what an interesting divergence. Even the U.S. dollar suffered. We had commodities, stocks, bonds blistered, short-term, long-end. But I did find one asset class, and that was China, what people are already calling a bubble, which to me means there's probably room to grow. The Shanghai Index and equities across the board. Any thoughts there?
If you're flying at 30,000 feet and you're looking down at the world and you say, where's the currently, where is the strongest market? And yeah, I'd have to go China. China for the last several months has really been exuberant to the upside. You can't forget the Japanese market, and Nikkei 225 also looks attractive. So yes, there are times when, you know, you rotate. Again, if you have that global view, you do rotate. And right now, China seems to be the place I'd want to concentrate that in Japan.
You know, when you talk about higher rates, of course, that brings to mind thoughts of this 30-year bull market we've seen in bonds. And we've all been trained, I think, for decades by market materials and literature to have that solid allocation of bonds, regardless of our age, unless you're, you know, your 20s or 30s or something. But for most of us, it's an important aspect of the portfolio. We're getting warning signs from folks, veterans like yourself, Bond King, formerly of PIMCO, Bill Gross, and many others in this sector warning that that bull is over, and they're very concerned of a primary downtrend there that could last years, even decades. Any thoughts?
Yes. Fortunately, we don't have in front of us a 60-year picture of interest rates. And it's actually a 30-year cycle, 30 years up, 30 years down. I remember, in fact, I was on a TV show not too long ago, and this young man was complaining. He was sitting next to me. He was so worried. Oh, my gosh, mortgage rates are going up to 4%. And I looked at him. I said, I had this shocked look on my face. I said, excuse me, young man. I said, give me a break. I bought an apartment in New York City 20 years ago, and it paid 9.5%. And I was kissing the bank for thanking. I was thanking them for getting only 9.5%. I said, what are you talking about? Now, if you look at that 60-year picture, guess what? We've had 30 years from the early 80s all the way down to where we are now, where rates have come down. If you believe in long-term cycles, and that's, of course, where I'm at, and I won't live 30 more years, but I'll tell you, the next 10 or 15 years, you're going to see rates slowly start working their way higher. And that's what the Bill Grosses of the world are saying, because as you know, rates slowly work their way higher over the next decade or two or three. Guess what? Bond prices come down. So you have basically, not on short term, but on a longer term basis, an asset that you got to be very, very careful with.
So that would seem to indicate that a re-weighting of a typical portfolio, would you redirect funds into equities with global exposure, perhaps global bonds and commodities?
Look at high-yielding equities. You know, the utilities under pressure here. I think they're going to continue under pressure. That would be a place I would look at. Not right away. Wait till you feel comfortable that the utilities have bottomed. I think you'll find some very, very nice long-term yields there. And you're right. I think you start looking globally. Munis are not bad. Tax-free munis, that's a nice suggestion.
Plus, you have the benefit of the tax-free aspects, for at least for your state taxes, that is. So very, very good. And I guess then, as far as precious metals, you've covered those bases pretty well. Anything else on the radar screen that you see headed this way? My guess is someone with your perspective and experience likely is watching several key events that might impact investors in the coming months and years.
If you agree with me that we're in a secular long-term bull market, with periods where we have bear markets, by the way, and if you're starting to be a little concerned like I am about the flashing light on my dashboard, you're saying to yourself, well, you know, where could I go? You have to start thinking sector rotation. There are 10 S&P sectors. Four of them I still think are attractive. Financials, consumer discretionary, healthcare, and technology. The other six, different degrees of neutral to down. So I think you have to be sector and stock specific over the next 6 months or so.
We even saw signs of that last week where the Dow suffered so much on interest rate concerns, but the tech stocks were virtually unfazed, ending near break even, while the S&P and the Dow, the larger cousins there, suffered sharp declines. I think it's more to it than that. Of course, the major international exposure was impacted by a strong dollar. Of course, those exports in the multinationals, whereas the techs are not quite as affected by that. Could you please tell people more about Altera and the wealth management strategies that you have there and how they can get in touch with you if you'd like to?
In 2007, I retired. It lasted literally, Chris, it lasted 2 weeks. And I got a phone call from my cousin Anthony, who lives in Switzerland. He was a part of a company called Russell & Company, which we all know, in Seattle, Washington. And the top management of Russell retired, and so they all decided to start a little bit of a company, and that became Altera. Tony, my cousin, great exposure to the Mideast and in Europe. And that's when we started to advise those people. We have some funds, high dividend ethical investing fund, which has done very, very well and fits into what you and I were talking about, conservative long-term investing. It's global. I'm having fun, keeping my finger in the pie, and my wife and I just bought the family farm, so picking the horses and the chickens.
Marvelous. That's great. We actually have chickens ourselves on our family property, and we're going to look forward to hopefully having you back on GoldSeek.com radio.
Okay, Chris. Thank you for your invitation. Thank you, sir.
Our featured guest today has over 25 years of investment experience, author of several bestsellers, and we'll let him get into all the details of the latest and near the end of this broadcast. How's the weather today, Dr. Stephen Lieb in the New York area?
Well, you know, Chris, if you had called me about an hour and a half ago, I would have said it was sunny and really beautiful. Now it appears to be getting overcast, and I hear we're going to get very, very cold weather coming in pretty soon. Days, I mean, really, really cold weather.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, maybe it's the last, you know, shots over the bow before spring. Let's certainly hope.
Yes, yes, that could be it.
Very good. Well, I wanted to begin, if we could, today with the U.S. equities markets. This is what people want to hear about. We had Dr. Burton Malkiel on recently. He claims we're way extended when he looks at his CAPE index, the Case-Shiller price-to-earnings metric. He's just concerned that over the long term, we'll see more of a return to the mean, that the pendulum is likely to swing back towards reality. Any comments here?
Well, I think that, you know, you have to start out with the assumption or the realization that most of the models of the stock market have been based upon, you know, the period probably beginning in 1929 and going through beginning of the century or mid-century, et cetera. And I think we're now in an entirely different period. And I think what's high and what's low and what defines valuation, et cetera, are really different rules that apply. I'm not sure that we understand all the rules quite yet, and I'm not sure, you know, that they're fully in place yet, but I am pretty sure that we're in a world that's changing in a fairly dramatic way. And, you know, a very good friend of mine who's been enormously successful at a lot of different things, among them making money, you know, classifies today as the most disturbing time in modern history, literally. That I think is a quote from him, most disturbing time in modern history. And, you know, it's somebody that he's not always right. No one is. But, you know, he's got a historian's perspective on things. And I think that, you know, it is a very disturbing time. It's an exceptionally disturbing time. I mean, you know, you just look at what's going on in Europe, between the haves and have-nots, whether you're talking about in a military sense, which is certainly the case between Russia and the Ukraine, or you're talking about it in an economic sense, which is the case with Germany and Greece. You just know that there's a lot of situations in the world right now which are, you know, all possible points of inflection, and all could lead to well, I don't want to say chaos, but could lead to, you know, major changes. I continue to believe that, you know, China is, that things are gravitating from west to east, that things are headed toward China. They appear to be best positioned, in my opinion, for what could be an entirely new and different type of world than one we've experienced up to now. We, meaning those that, you know, were alive at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and, you know, up to people that are alive today.
You talk about reaching a new threshold, an inflection point, a pivot point, where that chaotic system might just tip, you know, that tipping point that chaos theorists are.
Yeah.
And I think this is so key because you're echoing the sentiments of so many of the great guests we've been fortunate enough to have on the show. Everyone has a different perspective, but the arrows are starting to line up in the same vector here. And I wonder if you might try to look forward and give us an idea of what that tipping point might be.
It could be something as small, and I say small as the economic equivalent might be, you know, Greece leaving the European Union, the Eurozone. I don't think they'll necessarily leave it this time, but, Greece with its 50% youth unemployment rate and Germany, which is running, you know, not full throttle, but certainly doing extremely well, they really can't be in the same monetary system and, really share the same currency. It just doesn't make sense. And, you know, tipping point could be they're dropping out. A tipping point could be, a bigger war in the Ukraine. And, you know, a tipping point could be, you know, ISIS making headway into Saudi Arabia, or the Houthis making a headway into Saudi Arabia. I mean, there are so many areas of the world where we are extremely vulnerable, not just in a geopolitical sense, but also in an economic sense. And I do think that we're headed for a world in which the dollar will no longer reign supreme. I think we're going to head back toward some sort of metallic monetary standard, one in which gold and its correlates, have a much more active role to play. You know, I'm not sure exactly what that'll look like right now, but, you know, I would guess something, you know, along the lines of Bretton Woods. And it just seems inevitable to me that that's where we're going. And I think that that's why I'm writing my next book, just basically as a case for gold and, you know, how we got into this situation. I mean, America has become a country in which, you know, there's no more long term in America. Everything is short term. Everything is, you know, today's success. And, how have you done, you know, in the last 10 minutes? This is not the way to plan out a century or plan out, you know, another 20 or 50 years. This is just, you know, instant gratification. And that's been a long time coming. You know, we were a country that, you know, really cherished our savings and our ability to, you know, use our savings to invest, et cetera. That's just gone by the wayside, Chris.
This is a first. You know, in nearly a decade here on the show weekly, I think that was the first time a guest has proposed a new Bretton Woods-like agreement. Europe was the straw man at that meeting, and of course the United States was the giant in the room. This time, China and other BRIC nations perhaps dominating.
You would. I mean, it's not so much BRIC nations per se, but it's, yeah, I mean, it would certainly be China. And I think the Eurasia and perhaps parts of Eastern Europe, maybe even extending as far as Germany, you know, would be the kind of block you'd be looking at. As I said, everything's moving east. I mean, the data that I think I saw yesterday, I mean, you can mention it, but I just wanted people to realize I'm not 100% sure. But I believe that China bought all the gold that was available, all the gold that was mined, and that could have been bought in January. They're obviously accumulating literally as much gold as there is out there to be accumulated. At least they did in January, and I think all along they've been accumulating tremendous amounts of gold. I mean, the numbers you see from China have all been coming out of Hong Kong. But now China has their own gold exchanges, and an awful lot of that gold that is traded on that exchange ends up, it is gold bars in either Chinese banks or, you know, wherever, stored, et cetera. I have no idea how much gold China has, but I think it's a lot more than upper-end guesses would suggest. You know, they're preparing very deliberately, very relentlessly for, you know, a new type of world order, a new world order.
Well, I think you really hit the nail on the head with the PBOC and their precious metals operations. We have simply no idea. It's a big wild card how much of the metal has been accumulated because, as I'm sure you know, they only give us a glimpse into that. I think it's every 5 years. You know, 2015 started out similarly to 2014. We had gold, silver moving sharply higher in tandem. And then January marked the best monthly gain yet again for the yellow metal this year, due in no small part, I'm sure you'd probably concur, with global currency issues. You know, we saw the madness in Switzerland, trouble in Greece. I wonder if you might give us an idea of whether or not this could be the year that we do find the floor.
I think there's a good chance we found the floor or have come very close to the floor, you know, in the 1100s for gold, I guess mid, low 1100s. I don't think we'll go much below that. In fact, I don't even think we'll, you know, we may have already tested that. The real question for me, and tested successfully, the real question for me is when do we start, you know, the new and great bull market, one that I think could take us all the way up to 10,000. I doubt that it'll be this year. I think more likely next year or 2017, something like that. But it's going to happen. And when it does happen, it's going to be, you'll know it. I mean, there'll be no doubt it's happening.
That's an interesting point, and you just sparked this memory for some reason. You might recall over history, we've had a tendency for, particularly during the 90s, that is, where we had more liberal-oriented administrations in place, stocks simply outperformed virtually every other asset. And then when more conservatives came into play in the Oval Office, of course, you saw the commodities simply skyrocket. It tends to be a correlation there. So it's interesting that your 2016-2017 thesis coincides with the most likely change in the guard, if you will, in party lines.
There could be, I mean, you know, a definite change in the guard. And a change in the guard would be one that, you know, is not so favorably disposed toward the Fed. And if that's the case, you know, ironically, you're going to see big deficits in the government budget, probably used to induce growth rather than just, you know, throw money away. Those growth-oriented policies, which I think you will see if you got a change in government, would probably set the stage for a lot more inflation, commodity scarcity. And you're certainly going to see that in India, and I think you're going to see it more than people expect in China. So, yeah, I think the stage could be set for, that's a good point about the election, 2016-2017, depending on, you know, how that turns out. A president from the other party would ironically be more disposed toward growth created by, let's say, industry government partnerships rather than just the Fed. I mean, you know, we're in a world right now in which the Fed writes and controls monetary policy completely. European Central Bank, the Federal Reserve Board, I mean, these are the two most important policymakers in the world today. You know, my guess is I'm not taking a moral or a political making a moral or political judgment on this, but I don't think that this has resulted in great things. I mean, I think that you've got, you know, vast inequalities across the globe and inter and intra countries inequalities are enormous. And, you know, the other day, Jeb Bush went to Michigan, and I think that's a state a Republican hasn't carried probably since Romney or someone, presidential candidate, maybe Reagan carried, I'm not sure. But, and he spoke about, you know, the middle classes and bringing growth back, boosting the middle classes. Well, you're obviously not going to do that with zero interest rates, just not working. You may have a completely new calculus for governing the economy than the one we've been operating under the last six and what promises to be 8 years. And it could be very interesting.
Well, you brought up one of my favorite topics, calculus. So give us integration by parts. Give us the derivative here. Give us the double integration where we can revitalize the middle class. I would like for us to evaluate the integral in such a way that it can reestablish the heartland and the backbone of the United States.
It starts and ends with infrastructure. You know, this massive infrastructure deficit. I mean, and I think it will be, you know, infrastructure that is the key buzzword for the next at least decade, maybe next generation. You know, you're talking about a need for, you know, many, many, many trillions of dollars of infrastructure spending to, you know, get the world on a fairly decent foundation, pardon the pun. I think that's where, you know, money will be spent. And it's interesting that this world of ours, or at least this country of ours, has morphed from a so-called military-industrial complex, which had its own problems under Eisenhower. I mean, that was Eisenhower's, I think, farewell speech, where he referred to the military-industrial complex, and that we have to watch this. And he's right. You do. There are risks to a military-industrial complex. But we've gone too far in the other direction. And, you know, what we have now, rather than a military-industrial complex, I think we have a financial-legal complex. Finance and legal and lawyers and investment bankers really do very little in terms of creating real productivity in the economy and creating the kinds of infrastructure that allow transportation to flow, that allow water to flow, that allow for cheaper energy and more sustainable energies. You know, it's these kinds of things and these kinds of goals that I think China gets and has been, you know, very busy implementing that we just don't have any clues about. I mean, we tend to be very short-sighted, and I think one of my favorite examples has become, you know, the idea of a wind turbine. You know, a wind turbine, how it takes a while to build. There's a tremendous upfront cost. And, you know, so you're building something, you're spending a lot of money, and you're not getting anything in return. Right away. You sometimes have to wait years, but, you know, at the end of a certain period of time, you've got a massive amount of free energy, you know, for, you know, 20, 30 years. We don't approach things in that fashion. We want results here and now. And I think that has to change. We have to become much more long-term oriented in this country in order to really, you know, create something good. And I think there's a good chance we will. The Chinese certainly get it. And I think, you know, they're going to take a lot of their Asian and Eurasian partners along with them. Even places like Saudi Arabia, China's been involved in creating renewable energies there, solar energy in Saudi Arabia, believe it or not. It's changing, and we're going to have to take a lesson from the East if we're going to keep up and want to be, you know, a significant part of the new economic structure.
Integrating into that structure, I think, will pose incredible challenges. It's going to require leadership.
I think it's going to require much higher caliber leadership. I think that we have to take lessons from China without becoming enamored of China. And, you know, one of the lessons that you take from China is you go back to Confucius, which is, what, 2,500 years ago, something like that. I mean, he's still there. I mean, you know, people still, quote Confucius. They he's part of the body politic in China right now, has been for the last 2,500 years. And, you know, he was the one that brought up the idea of a meritocracy. Now, China's not a complete meritocracy. We all know that. I mean, you know, Xi's been very busy rooting out corruption. But I think we have to buy more into that idea that people are equal. Give everybody a chance. Give people more of a chance and be long viewed in terms of doing things. A lot of what, you know, China does, they are long viewed. They're meritocratic. It's the kind of stuff that we used to do. And we used to do it really, really well. But we've sort of lost our way over the past. Well, I would date it in the very early 70s. We lost our way. It was like once we went off the gold standard and we remained the reserve currency in the world. I mean, we sort of had our cake and could eat it too, spend whatever we wanted, and really didn't have to answer to anyone. There were no constraints on what we could do, and we did everything. I think we've got to get back to a much more disciplined way of life in order to. You know, really succeed. But I think there's a good chance that we will, a very good chance.
Studying last night China's history, we all know gunpowder, all these amazing scientific achievements that emanated from that land. But fewer folks, I think, realize that it was initially an elixir given to the emperors to extend longevity. That's the origins of saltpeter as we know it today. We can learn and we can adjust and we can adapt and we must. And I think you've underscored and highlighted that. so well. So let me shift over here to a related topic, and that is exchange-traded funds, the ETPs. They are showing huge inflows relative to the last 3 years of the yellow metal. Folks are stepping up. They want to add that gold to their portfolios. The ETFs have to accumulate huge bullion bars. Do you see this as a fundamental shift, a sea change that could bode well?
I mean, I see it's certainly part of a sea change. I mean, the last thing people would expect in the face of a dollar, which has been on a, you know, near historic tear. I mean, you know, just absolutely rising in a massive way. The last thing people would see would expect would be a strong gold market. I mean, you know, typically there's the association reflexive, it may be, but there's still this association between a strong dollar and weak gold, and weak gold and a strong dollar. So that, I mean, and weak dollar, strong gold. But to see the dollar and gold both, you know, firm together is very unusual and really does suggest that gold is ignoring the, quote, bad news of the strong dollar. And I think that that's very positive for the yellow metal. It is extremely positive.
People that I read online and elsewhere are pointing to the crude oil implosion and bracing for a commodity market implosion, and particularly the precious metals. But, you know, I can't help but wonder if maybe that is short-sighted, pointing back to 2007, 2008. Crude oil had its big run and then collapsed, and the credit crisis seemed to follow. But I don't see that occurring this time, and I wonder if you share those thoughts.
I think that low oil prices are, you know, they're a mixed bag in the U.S., but, you know, more positive than negative. I don't see any, you know, major vulnerabilities here. I think the stock market is certainly overvalued, and you mentioned a guest that you had that said it was extremely overvalued. Yeah, you can, you know, I wouldn't argue with that, but typically in order to get stocks, in order to create a major catastrophe, you need a catalyst. And yeah, that could happen in Europe. That could happen, I don't know, I guess in Russia, the Ukraine. I'm not sure exactly what form it would take there. It could certainly happen in Saudi Arabia with ISIS, etc. But, you know, absent a catalyst, you're not really going to see a downturn in the market. I mean, and, you know, $50 oil, remember, came after the market started falling. That was basically in, I think, 2009. We had $50 oil, and then it quickly shot up again to 70, 80, and then eventually about 120. And then, you know, you've had this downturn, and the downturn is very curious. I mean, it certainly has a far different look to it than it did in 2008, 2009.
As this discussion winds down a bit, just touch on the interesting development with the ruble market. You know, we saw cracks in the seams in that currency, and you alluded to currency weakness with the dollar soaring, resulted from the oil implosion. And we saw gold increase by over 100% in just 7 weeks' time. I've been posing this to the guests on the show, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about the abruptness of that climb and whether or not we might see something similar in terms of gold relative to dollars in the coming years.
Oh, I think you definitely will. I mean, I think that, you know, again, when gold starts going, I mean, you'll know it. And it'll be absolutely, you know, breathtaking. And, you know, people won't take advantage of it. They'll just say, well, it'll pull back, and it won't pull back. And that's usually the hallmark of, you know, a major bull market. And that will start. I mean, you know, it could start next week, but my guess is that it's still about 18 to 24 months away before you really see it start, before you go through the old highs of what, around 1900. But as far as the ruble goes, I think I'm not bearish on the ruble right here, to be very honest. I think that oil prices are likely to come back. Sort of surprised. I know this sounds ridiculous, but I'm kind of surprised the ruble's held up as well as it has. And I think one reason it's not at 100 rather than 65, the Chinese. I think the Chinese have been very active in Russia, and I think they've created sort of a floor in the Russian economy. And I think that's part of their Eurasian, Middle Eastern strategy. And that's, you know, what I think about the ruble. I wouldn't mind owning the ruble. I mean, if I would be a buyer rather than a seller of the ruble right now today. And the other thing that could happen with the ruble is it might end up as part of a currency basket with the yuan and maybe even the mark if the euro breaks away. I mean, these are not predictions, you know, per se. Possibilities that can happen in the kind of world that we live in. I mean, you really can't rule out a whole lot of stuff, but you cannot rule out a new currency basket in which the ruble and the yuan and the mark and maybe some other currencies share a role and are convertible into gold. And you have, again, a Bretton Woods type of monetary system that at least governs the eastern part of the world and may, you know, spread to the west. So that anything is on the table, almost anything is on the table here. I mean, it's very difficult to see how things are going to play out other than to say that this is the time in which things are changing. You know, my friends were disturbing. It's a very, very disturbing, distressing, upsetting world that we're living in today on so many different levels, in so many different ways. And typically, these kinds of situations give birth to, you know, a new world order. And I think that's exactly what we're going to see over the next 5 years.
Bretton Woods Part 2. What an interesting thought. This is food for cogitation. I know my listeners are going to be digesting this discussion for some time. Dr. Stephen Leeb, we want to thank you.
Always my pleasure. I really like talking to you so much.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. There was a short but sweet article on Zero Hedge this week, titled Macedonia Central Bank Blocks Greek Withdrawals in Case of Greek Exit. According to the article, Macedonia Central Bank Governor Bogov stated that Greek banks in Macedonia can't withdraw cash, and that Macedonian banks are protected in case of Greek exit. He also said Macedonian Central Bank sees major risks from political crisis. Capital controls and the war on cash and bank runs continues on a global scale. It's happening to central banks. It's happening now to individuals on multiple levels. I had one small account I seldom use and did not realize it was slightly overdrawn this past week. When I went to deposit a check into that account, the bank told me they were going to place a 10-day hold on those funds because the account had been overdrawn. The bank manager had no way to override this because the system had it already programmed. Fortunately, I was able to deposit the check into another account at the same bank, which cleared the next morning, and then transferred the funds into the slightly overdrawn and seldom used account, which cleared everything up without a hold. But what a wake-up call it was. If the system has it programmed, not even your bank manager can help you out in some cases. And isn't that always the way? Charges go through instantly, but try to get something reversed, and it takes days or longer for your funds to wind back up in your account. Diversification is the only solution. More food for thought comes from an ad that popped up on Zillow when I was researching the real estate market this week. As we've discussed on this broadcast before, now that the institutional investors in real estate from 2010 to 2012 are ready to start selling those investments that have peaked at 30 to 40% appreciation from the lows in real estate. They need a ready, willing, and able market to sell those investments to. Quantitative easing takes many forms. I'm going to read you some language from a real estate ad discussing the Home at Last and Home is Possible programs. Receive free down payment assistance up to $15,520 on home purchases to $400,000. No first-time home buyer restrictions. 92% of homes in your area qualify for down payment assistance. The odds are you do too. Unlike most down payment programs, Home at Last and Home is Possible programs provide a free down payment grant of 4% of the loan amount on purchases up to $400,000 and is available to all home buyers purchasing their home as their primary residence, even if they own other property. These grants are free money to help the home buyer achieve the dream of ownership and never need to be repaid. The housing crisis never ended. The banking crisis never ended. The jobs crisis never ended. Are we approaching a repeat of 2008? Or at least gearing up for one? You be the judge. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.